Hey, welcome back. Time for another episode of Confident ROI, the one show you can confidently listen to and know you're going to get a real return on your investment. Whether you work in a business, work with a business, or working on your own business. From the man who's done all three, Alex Vorobyev. Hey, Alex.
Hello, Paul. So you're fighting with your mic there today?
I'm fighting with everything here today. It's just been a struggle here today, trying to keep my mic from flipping over and flopping down here. I need one like yours that has the ROI flag on it, mic flag on it here.
We can arrange for that.
So you've really, you got an old favorite, well, I shouldn't say old. You had a longtime favorite of ours here at OC Talk Radio, a guy who wrote for Bloomberg Business, who writes for the local Orange County Business Journal, Peter Brennan in here today. So I always get a kick out of listening to Peter here. Maybe it's because we're both Irish.
Well, I think it probably is part of your in-group, right?
So you're
wired to like them regardless.
That's now, what I'm you were saying before. Yeah, exactly, right.
And also, since you guys can just see me on a box and I'm not actually in the room with
we
you.
We have a tribal connection here for some reason, I guess.
You're not likely to end up in a warring faction today, so that's good news.
That's good news. So, yes, and are you talking about Peter's book? Is that what we're here talking about?
We're talking about Peter's book. We're talking about how journalism's changed with the digital era and what some of the lessons are for other companies. But he's also interviewed some of very famous CEOs and what he's seen.
Can
share what was left or what wouldn't be written about them in the actual articles and if he wanted to get future interviews. But now he can talk about
it. And can I tell you the key to really get him to talk about this story is how I heard about many of these stories.
I took him across the street.
We had a beer, yeah. But I do have some Irish whiskey in here that might entice him to tell more stories. I don't know about that, but.
That sounds great.
The Confident ROI show in 2018 is 61% more sober. So
okay.
We'll wait till after.
All right. Well, I'll step out, let you two talk here, but I just had to give a little background on Peter and OC Talk Radio.
Well, thank you, Paul. Peter Brennan, welcome to the show. As Paul mentioned, you're the financial editor for the Orange County Business Journal. You've written about 30,000 articles. Been published in the New York Times and the Washington Post, and you've written a book, and the book is How to Write at Work. First of all, welcome, and why did you write the book?
Well, thank you very much. I've written so many different articles over the years. I've been a journalist for 35 years and covered business for more than 25 years, I'd say. And I realized that a lot of people could use the skill set I've learned over the years, because I grew up in Hawaii where great writers do not grow up. You know, great writers grew up in England or Ireland or New York, but not Hawaii. And so I spoke the kind pidgin and was a bit sloppy, and that's how it is over there. And so when I decided to become a reporter, I was the guy who went out and got the scoops, and I left it to the editors to straighten out my grammar, make sure everything was punctuated correctly and the whole bit. And so, but over the years, I learned, grammar really is important. And my lack of grammar skills at times probably hurt me in some job applications and the like. And so over the years, I've learned these skills, and I thought other people might be able to use them. And so I had a fun time looking through them. And one thing I learned about grammar books is that they're all geared toward the person writing the great American novel. And by that, you want fiction, you want a lot of metaphors. Those sort of things. And you want to sort of allude to things, but not get right on point. You want the reader to discover what you really mean after reading 300 pages or something like that. Well, business writing is the complete opposite. You want to get right to the point. You want the reader to understand what you're saying right then and there. And so when I was researching this book, I realized that there are not a lot of grammatical books geared toward business writing. And the ones I saw weren't written by people who do it day in and day out. They were written by people who just didn't have that experience and the like. And so I thought, well, there's a little nice little niche, and I'll write it and see if it people are interested in it. And luckily, they have been interested in it, so here I am.
Well, that must have been challenging to be in a field where you're writing professionally, and you sense and you're getting feedback that you don't know all the rules.
It was quite challenging, and editors would throw their hands up in frustration. But I'm like a bulldog. I just keep plugging along and like. And now that I'm an editor as well, I really understand and I sympathize with them. And if you ever get a good editor who really improves your work, hold on to that editor. They're quite a gem. So.
It can help. I used to score high on the math scores and low on English on the standardized testing, and I work for one lawyer who just lit up my work constantly. And when I went to take my GMAT, lo and behold, it switched. All of a sudden, my English scores got better than my math. And I think it was just from having an editor that really drilled it into me how to be clear on our work.
It's really important. If you're in a business and you want to sell a product to somebody and your writing is full of grammatical errors, the person buying that product is going to think you're not as smart as you may really be. I've heard of CEOs sending out emails with grammatical errors, and their employees grimace at it, and they're embarrassed about it. And at the higher levels of business, and particularly those with an Ivy League education, they all know the difference between regardless and irregardless, and they all know the difference between good and well. And if you don't know the difference, they will think you're just not that smart, and treat you appropriately, accordingly, I should say.
Yeah, but a lot of times, outside of journalism, a lot of times people won't tell you. You can't write. In journalism, they beat it in your brain.
That's correct, because in journalism, you're putting out your best. You're putting out your story, and the editor's going to come along and improve it as best they can. And editors are trained that way. That's what they get paid for. And if there are mistakes, I tell you, if you're an editor, you're paranoid because you're afraid you're going to miss a mistake that becomes so obvious once it gets into print. And then your boss comes along and says, why didn't you see that? That's so obvious, And you take an average story, which is between 500 and 1,000 words, let's say 1,000 words, and each of those 1,000 words has 5 to 10 letters in it. So you can misspell it 5,000 to 10,000 times. And then we get the sentences, and each 1,000-word sentence, 1,000-word story has probably, I'd say, 50 or 60 sentences. So you got to make sure the punctuation is correct in that. You got to make sure the grammar is correct and the pronouns match what they're supposed to match and the subject-verb agreement works and the like. And so you probably got about between 10 and 20,000 ways to get a story screwed up on a 1,000-word story and the like.
And even though there's grammar check now, is it like spell check in that people are becoming worse spellers because the computer will catch it more often?
Well, what's interesting is I do like the spell check, and when I misspell something, I see it has a red underline or something, and I think, well, what's wrong? What are they saying there? And so I check it, I double check it, and most of the time they're correct, but there are times that they're not quite correct, and if the word is N-O, and you spell it N-O-W, the spell check's not going to catch that,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
So it has its good and its bad parts, yes.
Wow. So I find that when I'm writing, oftentimes I think I understand something, and I could talk about it, but until I put it down in print, I really don't. It's not clear. And if you listen to read some of the transcripts of the show, you can tell that I'm searching for my thought as I'm talking. But that's a reality as we talk. I mean, we just go with the flow. We change our perspective, our where we're going with a sentence, mid-sentence, but in writing, we're essentially taking our thoughts and as they're coming, but they rarely come out. It's a master who can constantly communicate in perfect sentences the first time. And it's not the standard standard output, is it?
No, that's correct. I don't think I've ever met somebody who speaks perfectly all the time. And so and writing it down will force you to think about your thoughts and the message you want to communicate much better than speaking will. Like, so it's always better to write it down than speak it, in my view. And everybody gets edited. Did you know that when Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, it was edited 86 times, and it was about a third of it was cut out? Can you believe that? Thomas Jefferson. You know.
Editing has probably saved a lot of documents from being unreadable, right? Or unusable.
That's certainly true. And in my view, you know, one of the problems with college kids is, you know, the professor says, okay, I need you to write a 2,000-word essay on this or that, you know. So the college professor or college kid says, well, I only have 500 words, so I got to stretch it out. And so they learn to stretch it out. And like, and, yeah, and that makes really bad writing, and they take that writing into the workforce. And I've edited stories. The other day I edited a story that was 2,000 words long, and I looked at it and I said, well, the last 600 words were unnecessary, so I chopped it off. I immediately chopped off 25% of the story. Like, and I have no regrets about it whatsoever, neither does the writer. So in my book, when you write, you must write concisely and not meander all over the place, particularly for business writing. You know, for creative writing, you can meander, and maybe people will stay with you or maybe they won't.
But that's a totally you're writing to entertain, where business is writing business writing is to inform.
And that's right? Correct. Yes.
And they don't want a gift. They want it up front. Have you found that writing for the new generation, are they getting better at it? Are they getting worse at it?
Well, it's sort of an interesting comparison, because when I was writing, when I started my journalism career in the early 1980s, we obviously didn't have the internet. Resources were limited. You had to go to the library and do your research. You know, there was no Google and the like. And so what happened is the writing tended to be pretty good and the like, but the research wasn't that good. And so nowadays, because of Google and the internet, you can get research at the tip of your fingers and get some really good research, as a matter of fact. And so the research tends to be better, but the writing is not as good as it was back then. So
it seems to me, as I read journalism, business journalism, it tends to be to just kind of throw a bunch of things in there now. Well, I'm going to talk a paragraph about this and a paragraph about that, and it does. They don't flow like they once did.
It depends on who you're reading,
right?
And like,
but just yeah. You know, normal copy on something, that seems that they just kind of keep adding stuff to that. It's like there was no flow here, or in it, but that might be my opinion.
Well, I've seen a number of stories like that, and also you must take into account that AI, artificial intelligence, has taken over some of the more simple stories. So if you look at them, and they'll take some of the data and that appears in Wall Street and the like, and just sort of put it into a template and put a story out on it. So those stories will appear the same over and over again. And then you have young reporters. You know, the media is in a business now where it's basically it's the revenue's falling, so the talent isn't there. The high-paying editors have left, there's not as many talented reporters or as talented editors there, and so particularly among the younger ones, and so they tend to put a whole bunch of stuff together and pretend it's a story, and then you get some of the older reporters who like myself. I like to think, okay, I'm putting together a story, and you're going to be entertained. For example, I was talking the other day with my editor, and we were talking about a story I wrote about Pacific Premier, this bank here in Orange County, and Pacific Premier has done much better than the other local banks here. It has a what they call a net interest margin of about 4.5%, and the other banks are around 3%. And so it's really technical, really wonky. And a lot of people would be turned off if I led with that. You know, Pacific Premier is a net interest margin, NIM, is much better than its competitors, you know. And so that's kind of, but I lead the reader in. Instead, I focus on the CEO of Pacific Premier. He was a guy named Steve Gardner. And he was a dropout of an MBA program in Long Beach State. He dropped out because his wife was having a baby and needed to get a job. And he's just a local kid. He went to a failing bank in Riverside, and he helped it succeed, moved it to Irvine, and little by little, he started growing it. Now, there's two competitors, two biggest competitors. One's called Bank of California, and they're the ones who have the new soccer stadium in downtown mm-hmm. Los Angeles. And so they had the backing of Hollywood heavyweights and the like. And so they were glamorous, and Magic Johnson's assistant was on the board of directors of Bank of California, and it was a star power. And then the other bank was Opus Bank, and so Opus Bank had the star power of some Wall Street heavyweights who invested in Opus, and they have a dynamic CEO named Steve Gordon. So you have three banks here. So I told the story of how Steve Gardner, he didn't have anybody. He was the underdog. He loved hockey, and so he always had his sons on the hockey arena playing hockey. He was an MBA graduate, and so he had nobody. And then he was beating the guy, Bank of California, which had the Hollywood power, and he's beating Opus Bank, which had the Wall Street power. And so then you had a dynamic of who he was competing against, and so I led with that rather than the net interest margin. And so that's how you build a story.
Is making it humanizing it?
That's quite the idea. And because behind every number is an interesting person.
Behind every number is an interesting person.
Yes.
Are the numbers more seasoning and providing people who like facts some data points?
Well, it's always important to, one thing on Wall Street, you can be inundated with numbers. I mean, just
right.
Oh, there are so many facts and figures and the like. And one thing I learned, and I learned this not the hard way, but by investing in stocks myself, you know. And when you're looking at a stock and you've invested it, there are three numbers that are really important to you, nothing else. The price you bought it at, the price it's at right now, and the price you want to sell it at. And those are the three most important numbers. And all the other numbers are interesting, some more interesting than others, but there's a lot of noise out there. You know, Wall Street analysts, they're not paid to sit around doing nothing, so they put out these reports, and whether something's happening or not, usually something is, but they put out the reports, and their brokers read the reports, and they call up the investor and say, well, we think this stock is good, or this stock is going down, and so they're always, turning the stock,
right.
So there's a lot of noise out there, and there's a lot of data points, and
And is that good? Good business writing, though, is rising above that. And I heard the term "don't bury the lead."
Yeah.
Is it hitting the reader right between the eyes with something that grabs their attention?
Well, it depends. You know, if it depends on the story. You have straight news stories. You have feature stories.
Let's talk about business writing.
Okay.
Like in business writing, what's and Paul's getting ready here for our break. So why don't we come back from the break and just talk about, you know, what's from a business writer perspective and taking some of the things and communicating story and having people with interest, because you might be talking about numbers, but I'm wondering how much of that translates when you're trying to communicate and persuade in business writing as well.
Yeah, I'll give you some examples. Yeah, happy to.
Great.
And while you're waiting for those examples, we want to remind you that this is a multimedia project here. Unlike most of our shows, there is a magazine that accompanies this show. Alex and his firm puts out Confident ROI Magazine. The most recent issue just hit the stands, but I have the last issue. I should be talking about the new one, but in the new one, I know there's an article about Google and some of the research that they've been doing. It's pretty fascinating about how the brain works and how people respond and how you train your people accordingly. In the previous issue, there are articles about Unleash Your Inner Supercomputer, Vern Harnish on strategy, Dr. Brad Smart on top grading. Really some interesting stuff. So if you want to read as well as listen, there are two parts to this media empire growing here. ConfidentROI.com is where you find both of them. The magazine, which is free, that's right, F-R-E-E, and the podcast. Both of them free information for you as Alex tries to spread the word about this whole neuroscience, using your brain to upgrade the operating system that came with the machine here, right? So all that and more, go check it out. ConfidentROI.com. I knew you guys were going to talk about change and all that other stuff here. I just got to interject off of that commercial. Will we ever have robot reporters? Will we ever have totally robotic news operations here? Some are thinking that way.
Well, you know, there are certain companies out there that do it right now, artificial intelligence. And
right, some bot is sifting through the stuff that comes in and putting it together in some sort of order. There are publications, what is it, Business Insider or whatever, that's just sort of a compilation of other stuff. I don't know if they're creating anything.
It could very well be, but Associated Press and Bloomberg, they're all working with it. And I'll tell you, you know, there are headlines that are automated off the press releases, and this has been going on for 10 years. And so the press release comes out, artificial intelligence takes that headline, takes that and makes a headline out of it, right, if it hasn't already been there. Then machines that are coded to trade on certain words will trade on that headline.
Isn't that crazy? Yeah.
Yeah, it is. So, right, you know, sometimes you might see some really weird movements in the stock market and you think, what's going on?
And the other flip side of that, and then I'll let you guys get back to this, to know that since I got you here, I see more and more where newsrooms themselves, ooh, are pushing their reporters to push their own news out through social media. And to the point where I've seen some of these systems advertised where you, the editor, can track how many of Peter's tweets got picked up and what traction his story got online. And I come back to Peter and I say, you're not cutting it, buddy. You know, you're a great story, big scoop, but nobody's reading it. You got to go out and push it. And you're like, me? I'm just the content creator. You're the media company. No, you're involved in this too.
That's quite true. We could really discuss that for a long time.
Yeah. All right. Well, I know Alex is chomping at the bit to ask you some of those other, but I had to throw those in. It talk about change. This is a world that's changing faster than anything I've ever seen before.
Well, yeah. Thanks, Paul. And we were talking there. And why don't we keep on that, Peter, and talking about the lessons you saw in how disruption has come to media, and maybe how media bosses avoided taking that, taking a hard look of how things were going to change, and did it take longer? And a lot of, you know, probably thought it was impervious. I mean, newspapers for a long time were one of the great business models, right? When they owned a town, they owned a town. They printed money.
That's certainly true. And when you think about the newspaper, like, if you were a business in that town and you wanted to get your message out, there were basically three ways, you know, TV, radio, and newspaper. You know, a newspaper had that sense, that advantage that it landed on everybody's doorstep and the like. And when the internet came along in the mid-1990s, the newspapers were urged to put their content online and the like. And so they did that, and the tech guys were saying, "Oh, well, you got to give it out for free because nobody will read it otherwise, if it's free or not." And that was a strategic mistake to give it out for free because it trained people to get free information on the internet rather than pay for it. Now, their theory was, well, you can have advertisements alongside these stories that appear on the internet, and that worked in theory at first, but then the cost of that advertising, the revenue you could generate from that revenue just kept plummeting and plummeting and plummeting. And so, you know, even though the clicks went up, the revenue went down. And meanwhile, the print issue, that's where the bulk of the revenue came from. Basically, the trend is, 60% advertising from the revenue from the print newspaper and 40% from subscribers. Well, as the revenue, as the advertisers started going more online, the revenue for newspapers started going down. And everybody started reading online, and then once the subscriptions started going down, the print advertisements started going down as well. And if you look at a chart of, say, Google and Facebook, you can see their revenue in the 2000s, you know, basically 2004, 2005, 2015, you know, it's like almost like a hockey stick going up. And if you track the print, the revenue of the print newspapers, they're going the opposite direction. And like, so it was clear, everybody in the advertising world went online, and that's where they are right now. So it was a strategic mistake to give away this content for free. Nowadays, I think what you're seeing is the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal And they have learned not to give it away for free. If you want to get their stories, you basically have to read it. And the Washington Post, which is with Jeff Bezos, they're doing almost the same thing. And I think they're leading the way in that sense. And so to get quality information, you will have to pay for it. Is basically what's going to happen going forward. And if you don't want quality information, you'll get half-ass information, maybe fake news, and that's what will happen.
Well, Bloomberg was giving it stuff for free for a while, and I dropped my Wall Street Journal subscription, but now Bloomberg's charging.
Well,
and it wasn't the same quality as the Wall Street Journal, and so I'm now paying Wall Street Journal because Bloomberg put up the paywall.
That's true. When I was at Bloomberg, each subscriber paid $1,800 a month to get the Bloomberg system. And the Bloomberg system is, we have the news and we have bond trading, and there was a lot of data. There were basically about 100,000 applications on the Bloomberg system, everything you needed on Wall Street to function. And so it was very good. And then Bloomberg, like the other media, we were giving our stuff away for free on the internet. And some of the subscribers were complaining, well, why am I paying $1,800 to read these articles that you're giving away for free? And so they gradually changed that, and they put a paywall up there. And it's been a problem for the media ever, because some people are used to getting it for free. If you want to read quality stories, those people have to be paid.
Well, and now the model's changing online with writing, in terms of people are supporting sites that write to subjects or styles, like the long form writing's taking off, and I'm thinking of a site, Brain Pickings. I mean, it's stuff that you'd never see in a magazine. It's pretty long and detailed, but it's stuff that's interesting, some of it.
It certainly can be. It's we're in the middle of a great revolution as far as the media goes, and so it's quite intriguing to see. And as you probably know, Facebook's hiring thousands of people to vet the information that's available on Facebook. And it's a daunting task. And I can understand why Facebook doesn't want to consider itself a media company, because then you open up yourself to libel lawsuits. Why did you allow this on your website and everything? So,
anything you remember from this transformation that happened to media instead of it doing that, you would tell someone in another industry that is starting to be disrupted? The auto industry probably never thought they would get disrupted, and that a company, upstart company, would come in and be worth more than all of them combined at one point, of the domestic automakers.
That's certainly fascinating, was Tesla and Ford and General Motors, and watching that whole thing come about. I certainly never thought we'd have riderless cars, but there you are. As far as the media goes, you look at the industries that have been disrupted, the newspapers, the music, television may very well, it's right in the midst of being disrupted. The Hollywood model is, look at Netflix and Amazon are doing their, it's got a new model. The old model was appointment TV, and now it's just like binge TV. You go on Netflix and you just binge on whatever you like and stuff. So, the models are being changed right now, and I think in the tech world, my experience has been the tech world looks at big industries and where they can make an effect, and they're looking at anything that's giant, like delivery, retail. Amazon looked at retail. That was giant. Google's looking at information. That's a giant industry. Tesla's in the auto industry. That's giant. So anybody that's in a giant industry that's particularly has high margins, profit and growth margins, you can expect there's some tech nerd out there looking to undercut you in a certain way. Healthcare. Healthcare is, 17 or 18% of the U.S. economy. And so I think you're just going to see an explosion of technology coming into that area. And this week, in Monday's paper, to give you an example, I wrote a story about this company called GoRN, and that's basically registered nurses. And what they do is they schedule. And the woman who put it together, is this app, is sort of like an Uber for nurses. And what she did is she worked in the industry for 10 years, and she was telling me that, nursing or hospital needs change hour by hour, you know, and so you never know if you're going to need an extra nurse or two extra nurses. You know, accidents happen, people come in, accidents don't happen, people don't come in, you know, so the schedule is always changing. And like, and so what she saw was the scheduling process basically took 5 hours, and they had to call registries up, and they basically had high paid executives making phone calls to find nurses to come in and work. You know, within a few hours, and like, and it was a grueling process. So she developed this app, and it's sort of like Uber, and like, and she switched this from hours down to minutes. You know, if a hospital needs a nurse, you just put the information into this app, and you know, it populates with nurses that are available nearby. And these nurses have all been pre-approved; they can be on the site within the hour, and problem is solved. Now, the companies that are doing the registries that typically prepare these nurses or find the nurses, they're going to find themselves really in trouble, and like, and they better start acting right now, because this app looks really dynamic.
Interesting. So there are people out there, executives calling to get nurses to come in, and then now you can do it on your phone. And so those nurses, are they pre-approved to like work at that location?
They're pre-approved. Just think of Uber. You know, they pre-approve their drivers, you know, make sure they have mm-hmm. a nice car and everything. And the nurses have to go through a more rigorous screening process, but they're pre-approved, and there they are. They're available, and they're ready to work right then and there, you know, within
sure,
an hour.
Sure. So, and healthcare is kind of one of those things like, oh, we can never be outsourced. We could never be disrupted. People are going to get sick, and it has to be done locally. But
that's right, yes. And there are a whole bunch of things in the healthcare industry. I mean, here in Orange County, I can tell you that it's one of the major industries here. And there are some things that are going on that you'll be seeing in the coming years. So,
anything you can share?
Well, I just shared the RN and the like. I just edited a story about stents, and it's a very complicated story. But basically, you know, Edwards Life Sciences here is about a $30 billion market cap. You know, they make a lot of stents, and so there are a whole bunch of other companies making certain stents that, you know, you insert into the body without surgery, right? So you won't need as many surgeons going forward. Right, you know, but you'll have to have certain specialties, like, and these are really specialized stents that will cut down the time you need for a stent. Say like some of the stents they last 4 years, and then you got to go in and get it replaced, right? Well, the stents that they're building now are going to last 15 years, and like, so that's, you know, two or three fewer operations that are needed, and like, so those are the things I'm seeing.
So that's another disruption. I mean, surgeons probably thought, well, we'll never be disrupted.
That's certainly true. But people are looking at wherever there's the people in the technology field are looking at wherever there's a high profit margin or high growth margin, how can they use technology to reduce that?
Well, it's kind of right out of Adam Smith that if there's a economic profit above the return of cost of capital, people are going to be coming after it.
That's right. And remember, in Silicon Valley, there's a three kick-ass rule. First off, you need a kick-ass management. Second off, you need a kick-ass product. Third off, you need a kick-ass industry. So if you get all three of those going, man, that's the product that Silicon Valley is looking at.
Well, and sometimes the first two can change. The third, the taxi industry was not a kick-ass industry.
Yeah, who thought? You know, and Uber is out there, and Airbnb. We were in Spain a couple weeks ago using Airbnb, and these rooms would have gone empty if we hadn't used them. And like,
right. So. I mean, I remember hearing about eBay, and I'm like, that's the dumbest thing in the world. How am I? I'm going to send money to somebody for something I haven't seen, and they're going to send it to me. Mm-hmm. You know, how's that going to work? And I remember Airbnb is like, you're going to share your house? You know, how's that going to work?
Yeah, and it worked out pretty well. And I got to tell you, I met a banker from Silicon Valley Bank, and he said eBay was one of the companies he missed. He thought the same as you did. What a stupid idea. Sure enough, it proved to be good. You know, eBay, it was interesting on that subject. Back in the late 90s, the San Jose Mercury News, which is obviously Silicon Valley, did a story on eBay, and the reporter was so impressed with eBay that he told his bosses, you know, you guys should look at this. Maybe you should invest in it. And so Knight Ritter bosses were aware of it, but they just skipped it because that wasn't their business. you know, and look who's much bigger nowadays. Of course, eBay and Knight Ridders, you know, falling apart, wherever it is, whatever it's doing nowadays. So.
Yeah, I remember when Microsoft was going public and I was in college and I thought, that's the dumbest idea ever because you can copy software.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, how could you invest in that if you can just take your floppy disk and go in and install it as many computers as you wanted? But
yeah,
it's hard to tell what's going to take off and what's not. You've interviewed some famous CEOs, a lot of them, and any lessons things you've noticed from interviewing them?
Well, let's see. I interviewed Steve Jobs, and let me just say, I've read several of his biographies on him, and he was a master at manipulating the press. Absolutely the master. When I talked to him, he was basically a brilliant asshole. You know, like, so, but, you know, a lot of these CEOs are brilliant assholes, but he was the brilliant asshole. Like, and one thing I caught from Walter Isaacson's book on Steve Jobs is that Steve in the 1970s went up to a commune and he learned at the feet of this guru who was speaking. And I think he really picked up some techniques these gurus used to really impress people, because when Steve would go out and do his conferences and its meetings, I mean, he had the presence, he had the stage presence to know when to enter, when to talk, and say, and one more thing, and the like, and that was a really famous one. And so,
yep. Did he edit himself? I mean, he said less than most. He didn't get up there and talk about technical things. He was, in some ways, he was in a lot of ways, more of a story and a romance than how technically advanced this new product was he was introduced.
Well, he was brilliant at it, because I remember I was covering the cell phone industry, and, you know, Motorola and AT&T and all those companies would come out with their new gadget, and they call it some really techie engineering term that nobody could remember. And when Steve put something out, he put it, you remember the name, you remember the iPod, the iPad, the iPhone. And you just remember, you know exactly what it is. It comes up in your image. And who can remember what a Motorola phone looked like in the 1950s? But I still remember an iPod, what that looks like. And so Steve was brilliant at that. And one of Steve's, you know, Steve was a master at marketing. If you remember Steve and Steve Wozniak, Wozniak was a guy who built the system. And Steve was a guy who knew a lot about building it, but he was a marketing guy. And so he would get out there and explain it. And he was great at marketing all from the beginning. I mean, you remember the 1984 Super Bowl ad where he tossed a hammer at the IBM machine. And so that was classic. And he would get up there, and one of his things was, if you have to break out the directions to understand a product, that product has failed. And so I remember once he was fascinated when iPad came out, and he saw a Colombian boy who didn't speak English, 10 years old, take the iPad and start playing around with it. He knew that product worked.
Right. They also did great at marketing. And in some ways, marketing, is that really the essential of business writing? And as few words as possible, make as big as impact as possible?
There's a lot to be said for that. I just say not fewer words, but the right words. And so, I used to write headlines that would move the stocks of these companies by tens or sometimes hundreds or billions of dollars. And if you use the right word, the stocks will react. And so, of course, I had to be right. If I wasn't right, they would kick me off the system there. But, you know, I would write a headline, and it would go out to Wall Street immediately, within seconds, and it didn't go through compliance or anything like that, not through a vice president, nobody. The bottom line was I had to be right about that. And so choosing the right words, the right message is very important.
And how do you do that? How does somebody find the right words? There's no manual on the right words. And Paul and I talk a lot about titling podcasts and how that you can have the same podcast, same content, but two different titles gets two different amounts of downloads.
Well, did you ever read Tim Ferriss's book, The 4-Hour Workweek?
I did.
And I saw that in the Barnes & Noble's. I thought, well, that's a bunch of bullshit. Excuse me. Can I say that on the radio here? because nobody works a four-hour work week. And so I picked it up, and I was going to critique it, yada, yada, yada. And then I realized, you know, halfway through it, he's not really talking about a four-hour work week. What he's talking about is how to choose the right words. He chose the right words knowing that people would be interested in the four-hour work week rather than actually working a four-hour work week and stuff. And so what he did was, you know, obviously he was in the beginning of search engine optimization. So, you know, he would go out there and pick the words that got a lot of hits and the like. And so he would use that. And so that's, you know, back in the, that's what they're using nowadays, as you obviously know. But, you know, back in the old days when you had newspaper stands, editors did the same thing as well. They, you know, they could tell which celebrities, which words worked on, because you could see the papers fly off. I mean, there'd be a difference between 100,000 and 200,000 papers, you know, and the like. So those obviously worked. When I was at Bloomberg, we did check our clicks and hits, you know, and the like, and see how many times our story, and we found certain words always worked. You know, sex was the obvious one. Warren Buffett was another one. Oddly enough, kindergartens in Manhattan was really popular, like, because I guess all these bond traders wanted to know where are they sending their, you know, their kids to. So
can I tell you another one? Our research here at OC Talk Radio shows Alex Verovia. If you put that in anywhere, gold, absolute gold.
Thanks, Paul. is that the Google effect? I mean, they're figuring out what people are clicking on. And is that, I hear that's why we get all these surveys, because people click on surveys, or not surveys, but assessments. You know, are you this type of person? Are you that type of person? And seems that numbers, six ways to tell your wife, you know, you don't like her dinner. You know, there's always, it's a number.
You know what those are called? Those are called, BuzzFeed did those, and they're called listicles now in the industry. And it's a listicle. It's a little like popsicle that tempts you with a list. The five ways to fix your marriage, the three ways to lose weight, the six things you didn't know about Gilligan's Island, whatever it is. And mostly it's just junk to get you to click. It's clickbait.
Yeah, the click, and that way the advertisement appears on there, and they can charge the advertiser. Look how many readers or viewers we had on your page.
Let's Paul, or Peter, we got a few minutes left here. Let's bring it back to the business writing. And you got someone there who's in their career, and what is the benefit of improving their writing for them, beyond just not being laughed at behind their back?
Well, I would say if you're not perceived as smart in your business writing, you won't get the promotion. And so I say pay real close attention to that. And if you go around saying good when you should be using well, pay real close attention to that. What you want to do is when you're writing anything, an email or a blog or something like that, everybody wants to be perceived as smart. Nobody wants to be perceived as dumb. And so if you get my book, How to Write at Work, I'll give you some tips on how to improve it. So it's available on Amazon.com, in case I forgot to say that. So to give you an example of how it can really improve yourself, and even the highest, the biggest companies use it. When I was at PIMCO for 6 months, I don't know if you knew that, but I was at PIMCO. It's one of the world's biggest bond managers. It has $1.7 trillion assets under management. And what they do is, I was a contract writer for 6 months, and what they do is they have these professional writers who help the portfolio managers and the management craft their message. And so they had two portfolio managers who knew a lot about liability-driven investment, which is called LDI, and it's a really technical, wonky thing for insurance companies. My colleague, an editor, crafted their message, 750 words, and said, this is a strategy the two portfolio managers are using. And as a result, they put together the message and they sent it out to email to all the clients of PIMCO, and then they eventually put it on the website as a thought leadership article and the whole bit. Well, one of those emails landed in the email box of GE Capital and their investment committee, and they liked the idea. So they put $500 million investment into that portfolio, that bond, I should say the portfolio, because of that one 750-word article. So, yes, words do matter.
That's a good return on investment.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. Well, it's been great having you on the show. And you mentioned the books available on the website or on Amazon, which we'll have in the show notes page as well. Anywhere else? Are you on Twitter, I think?
I'm on Twitter. I'm working on it. I want to craft a better marketing message, but I've been busy doing some other things. I have a full-time job as a financial editor at the Orange County Business Journal, so I get to cover an economy the size of Finland. You can imagine. Nobody else is covering it. So
I think they recommend that you work, you do your tweets while you're driving. That's what the long left-turn arrow in Southern California is designed for. When you have 161 seconds to wait for someone to cross the road.
That is certainly not. Those are the tweets that will get you in trouble, you know. So,
well, and Elon Musk, I think he's got a different kind of tweet.
That was a $40 million tweet. You know, that's what it cost him to get out of that.
Wasn't that amazing? I'm just going to jump in. I mean, the guy couldn't control himself. And sort of, what was it? He was kind of hinting that maybe he's going to take the company private or something.
Yeah, at a certain price. And there are certain words on Wall Street you use, like it's secured. The funding is secured. That's a specific term on Wall Street that it better be true, because if it's not true, the SEC will come down and hammer you. And that's exactly what they did with Elon Musk. Yeah. And of course, no one wants to force Elon Musk out at Tesla because he's so brilliant and entertaining, you know, in the whole way. So that's why the SEC, you know, reached a deal with him, and he had to pay a $40 million fine. So,
but he was fighting the short sellers, right?
And it's interesting. You know, the short sellers are out there, and but that's part of the game. It's like sharks in the ocean. You got to deal with it. So,
and as a financial journalist, you're kind of I don't know if it's the vassal, but your guys are in between all that, right?
It is. And, you know, I deal a lot with short traders, and I got to tell you, they are a paranoid bunch for a reason. I mean, there are 1,001 ways to screw them that you never hear about in usual Wall Street articles.
Interesting. Well, thanks for coming on the show, and it's been nice, and look forward to picking up the book on Amazon.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate the time.
That's it. You've been listening to another Confident ROI, the one show that you can confidently listen to, like today's show, and really learn something. Right here in Orange County's only community radio station, octalkradio.net.